Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to season 3 of the French Village podcast.
Wait a minute, Sarah.
I've got great news.
We've got season 3?
I've got great news, Ben. We've been renewed. You know what the greatest thing was? Is how many people on Twitter and by email tagged the Bulwark to be like, Bulwark, you must renew this show.
Can I just take a point of personal privilege to explain my joke from last week? So for those of you who don't understand this, Sarah actually is the Bulwark. And so when I joked that, you know, if they would renew us for season 3, that's like, you know, having Rupert Murdoch on a Fox News show and say, and, you know, saying if Rupert Murdoch were hosting the Fox News show, him joking, well, will we get renewed by Fox News for another season? There was never a chance, just like there is never a chance that Danielle Larchet will not be called Mr. Mayor. There is no chance that the Bulwark will not renew Sarah's show, no matter how much JVL may whine about it.
I mean, the thing is, I'm not the Bulwark. There's a great many people who make up the Bulwark who do much. I do have broad discretionary powers as to whether or not this podcast continues. I will say that. And so good news, though. I've decided that we should keep it up. So we are back. And so are most of the characters that we were left thinking might be gone forever at the end of season 2.
Yeah. So the first question I don't ask for spoilers, Sarah, but we need an explanation, and I want to know if we ever get one, of why is Hortense alive?
So I have the same question. Even having watched the show, I can't remember whether at some point, I'm sure they reference it, but whether they explain, you know, what one presumes is she's discovered and revived in some way.
I mean, she seemed good and dead. and the only good Hortense is a dead Hortense.
Well, I mean, it's a tough sentence from you. It's maybe tough but fair. I would say though, as far as deaths go, the getting shot in the back and left in a field twitching seems to me to be the more likely scenario in which there's not an explanation for coming back.
Hey, he was at least twitching. She was. There was no evidence of twitching on Hortense's part. There was on the part of Schwartz. There was some indication that he wasn't dead yet, and he might still have a little bit of fight in him. That was at least foreshadowed. Hortense had no pulse. She'd been lying there for a while. I mean, she was dead.
Yeah, I don't know what to tell you. I will say the show, I've mentioned this before, the show gets a ton of things right. I think its historical accuracy is mostly quite precise. On the drama pieces, I have some complaints often. In a show where the entire, universe offers you a great deal to be anxious about, to leave multiple characters with the expectation of their lives having ended at the end of a season, only to sort of revive them without a ton of explanation, is to me a bit of a cheap move. I remember being annoyed about this when I watched it the first time. Now, of course, see, I'm happy to see Hortense, and I'm happy to see Schwartz. Like, I remember at the end of season two being like, are they going to, like, bring in a whole new cast? Like, what's going to happen if all these people are gone? And so, you know, and I'm pretty sure that when I was watching this the first time, I was just like, click, next. Let's see what's, I'm not waiting any period of time to understand what's going on here. But not, I mean, it's, and it's not just Schwartz and Hortense. Sada is back. We have, let's see, who else? Morhange is back in better health.
Although De Caverne is not, which is a matter of some puzzlement.
Yes.
And they do look, there is some new casty elements here. Certain minor characters in previous episodes, particularly Cremieux, seems to be a much more significant character in this third season than he has been before. His relationship with his wife, who was really a walk-on character before, she is a more significant character now as well. And actually, Berriot, who in the previous seasons is very much a foil for the relationship between what's-her-name and Kurt, is now a significant character in his own right for reasons having nothing to do with his all of a sudden very pregnant madame. I just want to point out that no pregnancy has ever gone from 0 to 60 the way why am I forgetting her name?
Lucienne.
Lucienne, thank you. The way Lucienne's has, she you know, she sort of zips into the second trimester without, you know, showing an ounce of additional weight, and then season three starts and she's kind of 8 months pregnant. The passage of time can only sort of explain that.
Well, I was going to say, I do think there is a passage of time. Like, yes. I do think time has passed between season two and season three. And I can't remember, at some point they give you something to demarcate it, but it is
July of 1942 now.
Yeah, I think, but I think like at least 3 months has passed. I think it's when Danielle mentions he hasn't heard from Marcel in three months. So, and I just want to, I do want to say this broadly as we begin to talk about season three, that without spoiling anything, I think even with you only having seen the first couple of episodes, or for anybody who's following along in time, season three is tough. It's probably the toughest of all the seasons, and I was not dreading it exactly, but I'm not. Knowing more about what's coming is not makes me not dread it exactly, but it's just like it's a tough one. And I think you can see why that would be, as the season kicks off with you know, chaos around a train pulling in of I think they say foreign Jews. And I don't quite know what that means, because they don't seem to be of the same. Like, I can't, they don't all seem to be from the same place, because they're speaking different languages and some are Polish. But this is where, to me, it's the scene, one of the scenes that is most familiar from World War II Holocaust storytelling, where you see a train come in and it's sort of early days of roundups. No one knows where they're going. They still seem to have an expectation of being treated with some dignity, and don't have. They're more confused and they are scared, but they are not. They are not certain that they're in mortal peril, which we know because we know, just from the time, what trains of people mean. And so this is a season where I feel like it's where it intersects with a lot of what you've seen in Holocaust things, and it's just brace yourself for a tough season. I guess is what I'm telling you.
Yeah. So, a few historical notes to get us started. The first is on that point about foreign Jews. The French Jewish community at this point in history had two major elements. One is the indigenous French Jewish community that had been there for a very long time, many hundreds of years, or even at this point, 1,000 years. And the second element, and those are typified in the show by people like Morhange, who are, you know, native French speaking. They are quite integrated into French society, and then starting in the 20s, the early 20s, there is a large-scale migration of Eastern European Jews, including into France. This is also lots of people from Eastern Europe are migrating, you know, starting in the 1870s and 1880s. And this, is, of course, accounts for much of American Jewry is migration in, you know, the first half of the last couple decades and first half of the 20th century, this migration of Eastern European Jews. But a lot of people didn't get further than France. And this accelerates. So you have Czech Jews like Sara Meyer, as well as Polish Jews and a bunch of Russian Jews. And this accelerates as the Nazis start conquering territories. First, a bunch of German Jews come in who are refugees like Annelies Berg, the spouse of Cremieu, who is Austrian, right? So the Austrians, the Anschluss, the annexation of Austria by the Nazis is in 1936. A lot of Austrian Jews leave at that point. In fact, the policy of the Nazis was to expropriate all of their property and force them out. The policy was to make Austria what was called Judenrein, which is free of Jews. And so you end up with this very large population of refugees that are from just all wherever the Germans are occupying, and people flee to what was thought of as the biggest land power in Europe, France, which, of course, then falls cataclysmically in 1940. And so all of these Jews, both the native French Jews and the Jews from all over the rest of Eastern Europe, mostly Eastern Europe, but some from Holland as well, some from Germany itself, are concentrated in France when it falls. The French state, as the show accurately portrays, immediately throws them under the bus. And so we've talked about the edict of October 1940 before. One of the first pieces of anti-Semitic legislation they pass is denaturalizes a huge number of French Jews like Sara Meyer, who are, you know, French citizens, but recent French citizens. They all get denaturalized. And it also subjects them to arrest, as well as these refugees. And so the initial phase of the Holocaust in France, and frankly, the most successful phase from the German point of view, related to these foreign Jews, what are called foreign Jews in the show, which are actually a lot of them aren't foreign, but they are either refugees or recent naturalizees, recently naturalized people, or in the case of Morhange, people who just get mixed up with them. And so this is, again, quite accurate, and these people survived the war at a much, much lower rate than the French, the longer time French Jews whom the Vichy state was at least a little bit more protective of. All right, a second note. The date here is important. It is useful to think of Vichy as having taken place in two phases. One is the 1940 to 1942 phase, where it was not a wholly co-opted, you know, puppet state of Nazi Germany. It was really partly that and partly the remnants of the prior French state. In 1942, the mask really gets ripped off, and the reason is deportation of Jews as well as deportation of French labor. The show does not depict this yet, but the Germans were running out of workers. And so they basically conscripted Vichy to send large numbers of French men and some women to be laborers in Germany. And Vichy's inability to prevent, I think, I don't know that much about this history, but I think it was like hundreds of thousands of people being basically conscripted to be slave laborers in Germany, really pulled the mask off of who they really were. And so this is the period of that transition where, you know, the French gendarmes are basically doing the Nazis' work for them.
Yeah, and it's interesting you bring that up. I do think we get there. That conscription of the French men does become relevant, not this season, but later on. But in this season, even in these first two episodes, you get a real sense of where it's going. So first, the train comes in and unloads the refugees, and Dr. Larcher is trying to get Berio to take them and house them in the school, because Servier, who I want to spend a little bit of time talking about, Servier just thinks stick them in the train station holding room and whatever, we'll wait for the next train and it can be days and I don't really care. And Dr. Larcher is pushing as hard as he can. So this presents a real conundrum for Berio, because he wants to be helpful. He obviously wants to, he wants to take care of people. That's why he's part of the resistance. But he also has a printing press in the basement of his school that he definitely doesn't want people to find. And bringing all of these refugees into his school and having to house them is going to put that under a microscope. And so he is panicked. Larcher is panicked. And ultimately they decide, okay, they're going to take everybody to the school. But they don't have... and I think the show kind of does a good job of depicting this in a very practical way, where like the plumbing is not set up for this many people. They don't have beds for people. It is clear they do not have food for these people. You know, food is already scarce. And there is in the first and second episode, you get both the refugees coming, and then you see the actual edict come down that we are going to start roundups. And I'll say, knowing history in the top line way that I would say I do, as well as if you've consumed, enough stories or depictions of the Holocaust, you certainly understand what the roundups were and looked like. But there is something about knowing this town, knowing the police officers who are doing the rounding up, seeing the discussions of people who, you know, live in the same town as this goes on. One of the things that I thought it did very well in the show that was pretty interesting is, especially with Krimi's wife, he keeps saying, and this goes to your point on the historical side, about they felt like they were protected because he was pure French. And he kept saying, you are married to a Frenchman, and that was going to be sort of enough to protect her. That, and I think a combination of class, too, where they are very wealthy. He's French. He still is able to – he's being stripped of his status and yet maintains enough of it that he feels some safety. And yet he's just starting to turn the corner of, I'm not positive it's safe, and wants to get her out of town. Go ahead.
Yeah. So again, we return to this point that we know that this is the Holocaust. We know how this story ends. They don't. And, you know, they think France is under temporary occupation and they've got to wait out this bad situation. And, you know, we know that the Crémieux of the world had a better chance of surviving the war than the Sarah Myers of the world did, but it wasn't that great, you know, and that we also know that there were that things that people thought would be restraints didn't turn out to be restraints, you know, that like we know that a train of sealed cattle cars means people are going to Auschwitz or to, you know, Majdanek or, you know, one of the extermination camps. They don't know that, right? These are not, they think that they are being oppressed, deported, maybe sent to, you know, the euphemism was resettlement in the East. Like, their imaginations are not focused on the sort of exterminationist qualities of the Nazis. That's something that, you know, in this very period of time, the Eastern European Jews, as the Nazis are rolling over Poland and particularly Ukraine and Belarus and Russia, are, you know, being shot in fields in very, very large numbers, you know, and this is the one of the most intense periods of the Holocaust, but they don't know this. And, you know, they're at the end of the day, Crémieux is a very wealthy French industrialist, and he's still of a mind that he can kind of buy himself out of anything. And it's only just starting to dawn on some of them that that's wrong. And, you know, there's this very powerful moment where his wife is brought into the camp and she says to Morhange, it must be a mistake. I'm married to a Frenchman, and Morhange responds, and I'm pure French, you know, which is basically, don't kid yourself, it's not a mistake. And, you know, those class lines, those ethnic lines and nationality lines within the Jewish community are really breaking down, and the salient distinction is quickly becoming, you know, are you Jewish or does somebody think you are?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that scene. But I want to just spend just a half a minute on Mrs. Morhange, who is another character who's back, although she has a plausible reason for being back. We know that she has gone to France, to Paris, and that she has gotten her operation. We learn during a conversation between her and Marchetti that something hasn't worked out with De Cavern. We don't know whether that's true or whether that's just what she's telling Marchetti. But Marchetti, she says, you know, De Cavern was right about you. You want to be cruel to people to distract from how lonely you are. And telling him that truth, you're sort of not sure which way Marchetti's going to go on her. But hitting him with some of those truth bombs and end up, you know, he sends her to be with to the school,
Illegally.
Yeah, but for not wearing her star, which actually is another, I would say, piece of the something that gets brought in, where you're used to seeing the stars on people in a lot of movies about the Holocaust, but it's the first time a star shows up on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And that you see that it was an obligatory thing, that it was illegal for her. And she kind of talks about how she got caught between, she had to choose between breaking curfew and breaking the law that way, or not having her star because she needed to, I don't know, get home and change. I couldn't quite follow. But I just, one of the things about Morhanj being back, so I love Mrs. Morhanj. She is one of my favorite characters. This is her season. She's clearly, you can see that her role is shaping up to be a big one, because she's sort of taking a leadership role here with the group. She's trying to figure out how to get everybody fed. She's comfortable at the school because she used to teach there. She's comfortable with kids, and there's a lot of children.
And critically, she is, from a French-facing point of view, she's a person with, you know, she's native French-speaking, and she's a person with a weird kind of status, because she used to be somebody respectable until she was purged. And so, you know, just as Berriot is a figure of some respect in the town by dint of being the principal of the school, she is kind of formerly of that role. So she's presentable, but she can also, though she doesn't speak Yiddish or German, she's comfortable enough in the Jewish community that she can kind of go from faction to faction of the detained population, and she can kind of be their spokeswoman.
Yeah, and one, I don't know if this was clear to you or not, but one of the families that's detained is a family we've met before. So there is there are a couple of refugees that they kind of give a plot line, and at one point there is a clearly wealthy person who packed a lot of food. So everybody is starving in this. Nobody can get them food. The townspeople, you know, are having trouble getting it from the townspeople. And so, you know, people haven't eaten in days, and everyone's starting to get pretty upset about it. And so this, what I think is a wealthy person, has his like sausages and bread kind of laid out for his family, and they're eating, and he gets in a fight with another man, and Morhanj is also telling him, like, put that away, what are you doing, there's children here starving. But the guy that picks the fight with the rich guy is the father of the boy who was shot. This is the family that they were trying to move across, that was trying to be moved early on by Marie across the border. And he is there now with his wife and his daughter, because the boy was shot when Marie's husband abandoned them, and they get brought in with Sarah. So they have popped back up again and are worth noting as characters. I think there's a couple other people that pop back up in the season that now I'm sort of forgetting.
I don't think I had noticed that he was the same guy.
It is because he's a slightly bigger character. He's a small scared character in the scheme of things, but he has his own kind of arc, especially in this season. Anyway, doesn't matter. This is how I learned to avoid spoilers. So I also want to talk about Servier. So this taking people to the school. So Servier, up until this point, I would say we have looked at Servier as a bureaucrat that is kind of slimy, classist, racist, in that, you know, foreign Jews he has no use for, but seems to have some appreciation for the idea of, like, well, if somebody's French, that's different. He's the one who's always arguing the crappier side to Daniel. But, you know, I don't know that I would have put him in the bucket of somebody operating with active malice.
Gosh, right? I've loathed him from the beginning. He's the guy who, you know, when Danielle comes up with a plan to feed people, thinks it seems a little too communitarian. And I mean, he's on the wrong side of every issue. He's on the way too enthusiastic side of, you know, we'll name the hostages for you to shoot. And by the way, throw in the foreign guy because, though he's innocent, you know, he's not French. Sergei is pretty loathsome.
He is loathsome, but he's the stand-in for bureaucracy, right? And so it's not, he is almost a gross and an amoral person that is part of a system, and he looks out for himself. But I would say, I get the point I'm trying to make is that I feel like in the third season, he kind of tips over into a place that is even more odious.
That's fair.
Because I think he goes from being kind of like, I'm doing this for my career and, you know, I like to hang out with the high society, to I literally do not care what happens to these people. I don't want them to be my problem. Get them out of here. Like, if the kids starve, they starve. You know, like, he has a couple of incredibly, and he, on the roundups too. I would say that there was something about Sergei in the earlier two episodes where he would get this look on his face when it was handed down to him, this idea of like, go do a terrible thing. He seemed to wince and then come and make peace with it often. But I would say that now he's in a space of, yeah, we're doing this thing.
Well, and he's also in the spirit of as you say, the face of bureaucracy. You know, the fundamental choice at the beginning of the show, at the beginning of the season, is do you let these people, this some dozens of people, languish in a train station waiting room under the guard of Nazi soldiers, or do you move them to the school, which is a larger space? It's got it's got bathrooms, although not enough, and it's got some cots, and it would be the responsibility of the gendarme, which is French, who aren't, you know, murderous Nazis. And he is all about leaving them in the train station because that way the Nazis are responsible rather than the French state. The conditions under which he can assume custody of them and give them more humane conditions is that the French be responsible for it. And so he is opposed to that because he doesn't want to be responsible for these people.
Yeah, I think that's right. I remember watching this the first time and moving to a different place with Sergei, in terms of where I was putting him on my, like, the line of morality. And he was certainly on the negative side of Daniel, you know, as where Hortense and over further where Mueller live, but not so far. And he moves further down that scale for me in this season.
But let's talk about that scale for a minute.
Okay.
Because here's what none of them is talking about. You know, Danielle, who's painted sort of heroically because he insists that Berriot take them. He wants to find food. He's not talking about how to get them out of there. He's not arguing with the Germans. What the fuck are you doing? Like, where are you taking these people? These people deserve the protection of the French state. He's not doing that. And Berriot, who comes to, you know, pass Morhange some raisin bread over the razor wire that has been set up around his school, he's the most attractive of the bunch of them in this episode. He's not doing anything to get her out of there. In fact, he's more concerned about how to protect his printing press than he is about how to get the printing press out of there than how to get people out of there. And, you know, the degree of paralysis that even the good guys have on the big picture is so total that we end up morally giving them credit for very what are really very small things. And, you know, what's ultimately the difference between Larcher and Servier is he wants them to be more comfortable on their way to Auschwitz than Servier does. Nobody's talking about the big picture. Like, you know, we've got, you know, a few dozen people here who are heading, who are being kidnapped and sent to some unknown but very bad family. I mean, nobody thinks they're, you know, going to a good outcome here, whatever they think the outcome is. And there's absolutely no, there's not even discussion about what's going to happen to these people. And so I think it's actually an interesting portrait of how, if you're brutal enough, you can make people fight over the terms of the brutality, not the fact of the brutality.
When I was pitching you on watching this show, one of the things that I would say is it's a meditation on complicity. And what I mean by that is it is not a show about good guys and bad guys. It is a show that is trying to, I think, put people on a scale of complicity from everywhere from active, you know, menacing participant to a person who is doing, who's doing small things in the moment that make them look like they're doing the right thing, that are ultimately still 100% participating in what is happening. And until you get the characters, which I think is been gestating but is not fully formed yet, the people who are, that's why Berio starts to sort of blossom, I think, is because he starts to move in the direction of doing something to push back. And I think that Cremieux, who is also emerging as a more important character, you know, is helping to drive, and sort of Marie, who is another character who has this internal moral code that says, we need to do things to oppose this. We need to be actively participating. And I think there have been fewer of them, and as they find each other, and that part starts to grow, I think that is one of the things that for me makes the show tolerable as you go. Because there are people who are making, again, little judgments at the time that build toward something that looks like genuine resistance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you have, and I think what the show ultimately does really well, despite its plot flaws and plot negligence on certain points, is portray how daily life in these circumstances requires a million tiny judgments about how you're going to engage with that reality that puts you on that scale somewhere, that you actually can't avoid being on it. There's a very nice scene where Larcher is trying to collect food for the people in the school, and he's literally walking around town as mayor with a wheelbarrow asking people to give food, and he has this interaction with this one townsman in which the guy is incredulous that he would be collecting food for foreign Jews. He's like, I don't have enough food for my family. And, you know, in that moment, that guy becomes on the complicity scale, right? Are you going to help the mayor in some small act of resistance, or are you going to think very narrowly? And everybody was confronted with those questions. And one of the things the show does nicely is show how different people didn't always make the same decisions about how to behave. And there's a good example of that with Marchetti, where for, you know, personal revenge reasons, he sends Morhange to this, you know, who is not a foreign Jew, to the school. But later in the pair of episodes, he's confronted with these two German refugees who are posing as Belgian Flemish refugees, German Jewish refugees who are posing as Belgian Flemish refugees. And he pretty quickly figures out that they're Jews, and he has a kind of weird comic flirtation with the younger of them, who's the daughter, menaces her, makes clear he's figured it out, and then tells her her papers are in order and sends her home. You know, so even somebody as beastly as Marchetti, and he is, you know, as we've talked about before, the show's kind of wannabe Mueller, he's really become an awful person. He's capable of being sufficiently amused by this woman that he keeps her secret for her.
Yeah, and this is the character I was thinking of in terms of a new character that gets introduced that matters going forward. And this Marchetti having a feeling a bit of a connection to this woman. But let me ask you about her. Just, I can't remember her name off the top of my head.
Yeah, I don't either.
But even though she becomes a more major character, but what? Where would you put her age?
Oh, DeWitt is her name.
DeWitt is her last name,
yeah.
Which is her fake last name. I think it's Wittenberg is the name she has changed. But where would you put her age?
Oh, well, since you got me to make a wildly wrong early in the show age estimate at about what's her name, Hortense. But we actually know her age because she is born in 1906, according to her interview with
Marchetti, when they're going over her. Yeah.
So therefore she is 36.
Does she look 36?
This is not a good question. I you know, asking me how women look,
right.
I'm just not going to do it.
It's not fair to you, but I'm going to go into this just for 1 second, because it's actually something that sort of drives me crazy about the show, is how all over people's ages are. So, like, first of all, I already had my antenna up for Daniel and Hortense. Then now there's Daniel and Sarah. And, you know, kisses on the forehead, and clearly they're giving you some underlying tension,
sure,
between them, which
and I'm
drives
I'm still rooting for them. I think
come on, man. I mean, in this broad scale of the morality of the show, that's they're the least of the problems.
Oh, no,
but
come on. Danielle is, you know, seriously long suffering. If there's ever been anybody I've watched in any show who deserves to have an affair, it is Danielle Larchet. Sarah, I'm not a big fan of huge age differences, but these people need each other. You know, I'm totally ready to ship them.
Okay. Well, I find the Marchetti in this woman to be, just, I don't know. The show is playing at a real chemistry here that would cause Marchetti to behave in a different way. And I just, like, don't buy it.
Part of that's that Marchetti looks so young. He's so baby-faced. And
I mean, I would put Marchetti at 31, maybe. And I just think that she's 45. I'm just saying that I don't think that the show is always like on top of its how it ages people.
All right, that's fair. I think, you know, you have to suspend your disbelief about something, and in some shows it's that all animals can breathe on all planets, and in this one it's that you know they don't. The age of the humans is not always plausible relative to the age of the characters.
Yeah, these are things that only I care about, I'm sure. But anyway, what else do we need to talk about in these episodes that are important?
Well, let's talk a bit about the printing press, because this is a significant subplot. They've got to get the printing press out of the place within 3 hours, because the gendarme want to use the basement. It's actually not clear to me what they want to use the basement for, but they want to use the basement where the printing press is hidden. And so Berriot, and with the help of Lucienne, who turns out to know a thing or two about how to unfreeze bolts using a kind of acid that I have never heard of before. They spirit the printing press into the back of a truck and get the gendarme to do the heavy lifting for them, which is an inspired little thing. And at the end of the episode, they are driving the printing press away, having missed the opportunity to, they don't know that Cremieux's wife has been taken yet, but they get stopped at a Nazi checkpoint, and they make a run for it, and Cremieux gets shot in the leg as they're running away, and so it is a pretty taut ending. And I think at this point, the Nazis have Cremieux's wife, or the gendarme do. They've shot him, I think, in the leg, and they've got the printing press. So I think we're in a kind of an ugly place for our burgeoning resistance heroes.
Yeah, I gotta say, it's one of the things that I love in the time span that we've shifted is how Berriot has had sort of a physical transformation between seasons. He is grayer, and yet it is making him actually look like less of a nerd. Like, he always had this like slicked down that made him look just, when he was pursuing Lucienne, that I always felt like made him look just like slightly reptilian, or I don't know, but unappealing in a way that he now, when he's being pressed the way he's doing, right? He's trying to work the printing press. He clearly likes that work, but he is being put in tough positions to make choices where he's really on the line, and he is sort of sweaty, and his jackets are kind of hanging off, and he starts to take on that everyman hero sheen. That is sort of him growing into a different role in the show, and you see that.
Yeah, so he's I think the growth of this character is really interesting, and I want to do the totally unfair analogy to modern times with Monsieur Berriot. He reminds me a little bit of Liz Cheney, so. In the first few episodes, Berriot is kind of sleazy. He seems to be leering with respect to Lucienne. He seems to be, abusing, I mean, in a way that's I suppose, a modern gloss on workplace stuff. But, you know, running a school where you're hitting on the teachers is not best practices, probably even then. And he's toasting in the basement to our collaboration, right? He seems pretty unappealing early on. And then it turns out he's the only honorable person in town with respect to Lucien. He actually is much more appealing than her father about her pregnancy, and he genuinely doesn't seem to mind that she's pregnant with somebody else's child. So his attitude toward her becomes much less gross over as you get to know him. He's shown courage in public settings, both with respect to Madame Schwartz and with respect to the general political climate. And he is actually doing things now with Cremieu, who is he's genuinely putting himself in danger with respect to the printing presses, and he's doing it in a way that is pretty selfless. And so I have to say I repent my earlier distaste for Berio. And again, I have this, you know, to project this ridiculously into modern times, think about the way we talk about Liz Cheney. You know, this is somebody who, you know, lots of people have lots of reason to dislike. She's been unappealing on a lot of issues, from the kind of most, kind of belligerent sort of, you know, neoconservatism, interventionism, to kind of very unappealing views of sort of LGBT issues, right? She's somebody who lots of people have lots of reason to dislike, and yet the crisis of the moment brings out a side of that is genuinely principled, genuinely courageous, and it doesn't make you forget the other things that you might disagree with her or dislike her about, but it does separate her from lots of other people who you may worry have, you know, that there is no core to which they are true. There is no democratic core to which they would, you know, on the biggest issues, are they fundamentally in the right place? And I think Berio is somebody who the show spent a lot of time setting up how, you know, on lots of non-biggest issues, there's reason to regard him as sort of an apparatchik sleazeball. And that he starts out the show by showing up to take Morhange's job, right? He's also the only one who bothers to show up and give her a loaf of bread. You know, and so, like, on lots of small things, he's prepared to be a sleazeball. But on the bigger the thing, the more attractive he becomes. And I do think we've seen some characters like that in our day, too.
I talked a lot about this in the first couple of episodes about being like, I don't remember feeling this way about Berio. And I was pretty hard on him. And I think part of it is that, you know, when I burned through these seasons before, you get to see the arc happen quickly. And he obviously is trending in a better direction. And so you land in a different place on him ultimately. Than where the show starts out. Big ups for Berio in this episode. I will just say, on your point about modern corollaries to the narrative, when I watched the show the first time, it wasn't in the thick of child separation exactly, but we're still talking about refugees and how many we're willing to take as the United States and about the camps at the border and the way that people are being treated. I would say we were sort of in the thick of that in the Trump years, though, when I was watching the show. And I think we should be prepared that we're going to end up having quite a few things to talk about in terms of how many parallels there are this season to how we've been dealing with immigration and how we've been thinking about refugees in this country.
So one other character we should talk about is Schwartz, who shows up, as you pointed out, alive, not like Hortense, seemingly unscathed. He's got an injury from which he's recovering. He still hates his wife with the fire of 1,000 burning suns, but she has stepped in and is running the business and, of course, effectively turned it over to Daddy, which is, you know, that woman has a undying loyalty to her father, which her husband really dislikes. And she has a new lawyer who is who is reveals himself quickly to be a very bad guy. And he does this in a fashion that those who are not familiar with French history might not pick up on, which is that at this meeting, this is a guy who's sort of represents the Chamber of Commerce, and at this meeting where they're deciding what to do with respect to feeding these Jewish refugees or Jewish detainees, you know, basically raises the subject of who's going to pay for it. And Larcher, you know, tries to argue that, you know, there are ways they could do it with, you know, municipal forward financing. And he ends the meeting by saying the Jews have, you know, owe us since Dreyfus. And this is a reference to the Dreyfus affair, which is without going into the whole history of it, it's a set of events from the 1890s that loom very large over subsequent French history. Anne Applebaum has written about it as the sort of fundamental division in Europe, even down to this day, that the Europe, French culture was, political culture was kind of divided between the what are called the Dreyfusards, which are the people who believed that Alfred Dreyfus, this French officer who was accused of spying for the Germans, were innocent, and people who believed he was guilty, or believed it didn't matter if he was guilty because he was Jewish. And so when this lawyer working for Janine, who is herself quite the anti-Semite, reveals himself as somebody who in 1942 is still thinking about Alfred Dreyfus and the perfidy of Jews with respect to Dreyfus, that axis, no pun intended, between Janine, who is horrible, and this horrible lawyer who reveals himself very quickly as such, at the expense of her husband, who is infirm and making out with the help, I think is setting up yucky stuff to come.
Yeah, you know, and just to kind of go back to where we started, it's funny, we get most of our main characters back, with the exception of Dave Caverne at the end of season two, and then they add a bunch of characters in now who become pretty important characters. And so I'm like remembering, so like meeting Chassange for the first time.
Isn't it Chassagne?
I don't know.
I think it's Shasanyi, but I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, why I can't hear the names and I only read them. They only look phonetic to me when I like read them in the subtitles. Whatever. This guy, you know, it's the introduction of a new character, as is the woman that Marchetti, the Jewish woman that Marchetti lets go, as are some of the people who are being held in the school. And so, you know, it's interesting to see some of these people for the first time. As you note, Chassange or Chassanier isn't a nice person. And to see the first scene with him, I was like, ah, yes, you were revolting from the jump.
Yeah, because he's arguing against feeding people in 1942 because Dreyfus. That's right.
Well, he's also after Larcher's job.
Yes, they do mention that. And Servier has another yucky moment. Servier is explaining to Larcher that he wants his job. And Larcher says, and do you support him? And Servier says, not at this time, basically, which is also it's not what you want to hear as it must. Let's just say Liz Cheney must have had a lot of conversations like that.
That's true, although it also sets up a dynamic that I think we're familiar with, where you take the complicit humanist in a job trying to make the best of a bad situation versus the person who will replace them. And this is what you heard people argue in the Trump administration all the time about why they hung on and stayed despite atrocities, is they were like, well, you can't even imagine who they were going to replace us with. And you can feel
we call that the Cash Patel effect.
Exactly. And you feel that in the show with the sense of, well, Daniel better stay right where he is and fight for that position, because gosh knows he's way, way better than this person. I mean, he's not leading the resistance, but he'll make sure people get food, and it will genuinely concern him.
Right. But again, you come back to what the terms of the debate are. Danielle mm-hmm. will make sure people get food on their way to Auschwitz, and this other guy won't make sure they get food on their way to Auschwitz. Nobody's talking about stopping the trains.
So I agree with that. I'm going to interject just a slight bit on Daniel's behalf to say your point earlier about how people don't know where they're going. Daniel, too, does not know where. He knows it ain't good.
He knows it ain't good. He knows it ain't legal. He knows that he knows to protect the people he cares about from it. He's hiding Sarah Meyer because he knows that it would be really bad for her if she were in that group. And he's collecting food for them, and he's not thinking about, can we bribe the gendarme to let some of them out, right? There's just a limit to what he's thinking about. I agree with you. He doesn't know they're all going to be murdered within days. He doesn't know that, and you can't necessarily blame him for that. But he definitely knows that the SS doesn't have good outcomes in mind for these people.
Yeah. Agreed. And we are going to, man, the complicity conversation is going to get much deeper in this season. So, Ben Wittes, thank you for coming back for season 3.
Thank your bosses at the Bulwark for re-upping us, Sarah.
They have great taste, I got to tell you. They have great taste in podcasts.
Shows admirable tolerance for eccentricity.
And thank you to all of you for listening. We'll be back next week. And Ben?
And until then, Edith, take us home.
Nous nous aimions bien tendrement. On me t'aime tous les amants. Et puis un jour, tu m'as quitté. Depuis, je suis désespéré.
Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Love espresso, drip coffee, and cold brew? With the Ninja Luxe Cafe, if you can crave it, you can brew it. Espresso? Balanced. Drip coffee? Rich. Cold brew? In a flash. With Barista Assist technology, you brew with no stress and no guesswork. And make perfect silky microfoam hands-free from dairy or plant-based milks. Bring the coffee house home and unlock your favorites with the Ninja Luxe Cafe.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's,